How strongly do you feel about a cause? Have you marched against Brexit, for Black Lives or gay pride? How far would you go for your beliefs? Today we have a woman on Radio Gorgeous who is a young woman ran away to live at an all-women's camp against nuclear bombs at Greenham Common in England. She's written a book about her early life and how she found herself at the camp. The book's called Other Girls Like Me by Stephanie Davis. Stephanie is a communication consultant who now lives in the USA with her wife and dog. Hi, Stephanie. A warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, Josephine. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, where and when was Greenham Common? So a lot of people won't have even heard of it.
Well, Greenham Common was in the 1980s. It started in the early 1980s when a group of women marched to Greenham Common, United States Air Force Base in Newbury in Berkshire, which was actually 15 miles away from where I grew up in a small village in Hampshire. There were massive demonstrations there. Tens of thousands of women would go there. I went once where we all held hands and embraced the base. And so it was always in my consciousness, and I decided to move there after a couple of years, because it was such, we were also terribly afraid that there was going to be a nuclear war. We were seeing this build up to nuclear war in our own country, and it was actually United States cruise missiles that were using us as a kind of launching pad for their Cold War activities. So Greenham Common really was a mass movement of women. It was tens and tens and thousands of women who uprooted their lives and either came to stay for weeks on end, or came for a weekend, or came to offer gifts of food or firewood.
Was it a global thing? Did people from all around the women from all around the world come to it?
They did, yes. It attracted women from all over the place. In fact, my wife Bee almost came on her way back from a trip to Israel. She was in Heathrow Airport and she was like, maybe I should go to Greenham Common. And then she decided not to because she bought a rug and it was too heavy. So because of that, she ended up going back to the United States. But I met women from Australia, New Zealand, the United States, of course. There were a lot of American women there. It was definitely international, and we had support from people like Yoko Ono who came and visited the camp. So it was had global reach and attracted women.
Why do you think it was the time for women to do this? Where were we in the feminist movement at the time?
Well, that's an interesting question. Wow. So for me, it was the shock and joy of being in a women-only environment. So I'm not exactly sure where it fitted in the whole movement, the feminist movement, but it was obviously evolving so that women were having more sense of our own power, of how we could be in the world, of how we could be with each other in the world. So it was also a time of, at the camp and in a punk rock underworld, of women just saying, you know, we're not going to play your patriarchal games anymore. We're going to dress the way we want, look the way we want. So there were lots of different elements that came together at the same time, I think, because there were many different kinds of women who lived at the camp. But I would say that the women-only nature of it was just something extremely empowering for me, and I think for a lot of other women.
Yeah, because it was very alternative lifestyle. You know, everyone had Mohicans, bright-coloured hair, colourful clothes, campfires, smoking dope, singing, and vegans and vegetarians. And that probably felt so alternative then. I mean, it's become mainstream now. How different did it feel coming from Hampshire?
That's so true. It was a beautiful shock. I had never met a vegan before. I'd not met a lesbian before. It was, I hadn't spent so much time with women of different backgrounds before. So it was an amazing experience and opened my eyes to lots of different opportunities that I didn't know even existed.
Fantastic. Now, the inspiration for all your radicalness was your father, and he's intertwined in the book. I don't want to give too much away. Can you tell me about him? Because he sounds a really inspirational figure.
Well, thank you. Yeah, my father came from the north of England. He grew up in Accrington in Lancashire, and he was very much an angry young man of the 50s as he grew up. He had a very socialist leanings and very progressive thoughts about education, which was his passion. So he was a teacher, an English teacher. Then he became the headmaster of the school I went to, which was a comprehensive school called Tesbourne, and his passion for education was about making it equal for everyone. So he was very much against the public school, private school divide, and even the grammar school system. He felt that that education was the key to liberation for the working person, and that everyone should have the same access to education. So he put those principles into practice in his own school as far as he could, and he had things on his bookshelves that really opened my eyes to what was the injustices that were going on in the world and what people were doing about them. So there was Angela Davis and Malcolm X and George Soledad, who George Jackson, who wrote Soledad Brother, which was by a young man who was put in prison for decades for stealing $50 from a gas store in the United States, a young black man who ended up being killed in prison. So there was a lot of socially aware books on the shelves, The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist and things like that. So I felt fortunate in Hampshire, which was a pretty conservative village I lived in called St. Marybourne, that I had this exposure to a lot of progressive things, books, conversations.
Tell us more about your childhood. You sounded like you're a bit of a tomboy.
I was a complete tomboy. I absolutely loved living in a small village and dressing in jeans. And I loved it if people thought I was a boy. And I think that's because you had so much more freedom when you were a boy. I loved playing football. And I sometimes played for my brother's Cub Scouts when they needed more men in speech marks, but I wasn't allowed to get football boots, so I had to play in Wellington boots, but I still played, and I played cricket with him and his friends. So he, a couple of years younger than me, embraced me and let me do all the boy things I wanted to do. I climbed trees all the time. I just was very fortunate to be somewhere where I could do all that, and I was an absolute tomboy.
It sounds idyllic. Now, also, I mean, you are gay, lesbian now, and you're married, and you found that out at Greenham Common, but you also did have a serious boyfriend for a long time, didn't you? You know, you started off thinking you were straight.
Yeah, well, I was 16 when I met him. I didn't know.
That's too young.
It was way too young, and I didn't know there were any other options. And I was with him to the age of 22, when I went to the peace camp. So they were very formative years, and it turned into an emotionally abusive relationship, as I know you've read. So it was a very difficult relationship to be in and to get out of.
Yeah. Amazing. So tell us about your first feelings about being a lesbian. I mean, it actually, your friend at school, you seem to have feelings for, you know.
Well, that's true. My best friend, Bridget, I didn't know why I felt the way I did about her, but I thought she was really pretty. I really liked being with her. She's the person I thought about all the time. I had a boyfriend, you know, one or two boyfriends now and then, but they weren't the people I really thought about or had so much fun with. So Bridget, I think, was my first real love, in the sense that she was a close best friend. And who knows, in today's climate where young people are more aware of, you can love whoever you want to love, who knows if we might have been able to be in love with each other? I have no idea. But yeah, they were, and I had other inklings of feelings. Like, I used to watch, do you remember, they were called the Young Generation? I think they called it, remember them? They were like that band that were on those shows on Saturday night, and they were all these female dancers, and I had a favorite, and I would just watch her. And sometimes I would go to the TV and point and look at her. So there were things in me that were
And maybe, you know, so many women just go through crushes, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's like, which way is it going to go? You know what I mean? It's like, so tell us about Greenham, because that was like the flowering of you, really, completely, wasn't it? About how, I remember you saying just, well, the atmosphere and everything, but also you said, I remember you said, the touch of a woman's soft skin. I thought that was lovely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, it was liberating on many levels. On the political level, I was now living my principles. I could show that I was against nuclear war, and I wanted there to be life in a better world. And so there was a political side that was very liberating. But then I had not seen women holding hands before, or women kissing on the lips before, or women being in love with each other. It had not been part of my world. And I was just, the very first visit, that threw me, and I was very excited by that, and I developed a crush on someone immediately and thought about her all the time after I went back to be with my boyfriend as I worked out what was going on. So yeah, it was, the first feelings were very, well, I also felt like, but I'm never going to be able to be the lover of one of them. They're so amazing. They're so, they didn't feel as if I could be part of them. I kind of had them on a pedestal, the Gwen and women, as well as the lesbians there.
But also, what gave you the courage in the end to say, I'm going to go and live there? I mean, it really was brave, because all you camped out. I mean, you know, what were the conditions? I mean, was there a loo? Was there, you know, how did you wash yourselves?
Well, we had a loo. It was called a shit pit. So people, women dug a great big pit, a latrine in the ground. You could wash yourself out just with water in the woods, or go and have a shower at local supporters' homes. But honestly, none of that bothered me. I just really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun to live outside, to live in a tent or sleep in a Gore-Tex bag, which was like a sleeping bag you could sleep outside in. So you could wake up with rain falling on your face. To me, that was not a hardship. That was a lot of fun. But you said, what was it that inspired me to go there? So really, I was in this relationship. It was not a happy relationship. I'd now moved in with him, and I was sitting in the kitchen listening to the radio, and I remember it very vividly. There was an interview going on with the Gwinin women, because they were in the news a lot, and they were being evicted from the camp. And they were saying, we need backups, come and help us. They're trying to evict us. And I just said, you know what? I am going to go and live there.
It was a calling, wasn't it?
It was a calling. Oh, it was.
It's fantastic. I can't tell you how much I loved your book. I'm going to get my daughter to read it now. I was telling her all about it. No, it's beautifully written, you know, as well. It's not just, you know, a memoir. It's fabulous. One of the problems at the camp that you did come across was that the women, it was very, very, very strong feminism then. You know, it was, you know, that some lesbians then, they wouldn't talk to men, you know, they you know, it was very strong. So some of them didn't like men and even hated men. And that was the one thing that did disturb you, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was this lesbian separatist thing going on at the time. In the world, in feminism. And I was very attracted to it because I had suffered so much at the hands of a man, and I could see that men were responsible for war and for all of these terrible things that were going on in the world. So it seemed to fit neatly as an ideology, but it didn't obviously fit with the individual men who had been kind to me or had inspired me, like my father. So I do think it's similar today. We have a patriarchal system which has been put in place by men, mostly for the benefit of men. Women take part in that and benefit from it, but you know, it's not about the individuals, it's about the system that has been created. But at the time, I was very young, it was all new to me. I thought, oh my God, so I'm supposed to hate all men now. You know, I just was attracted to the most radical part of women's thinking, some women's thinking. It wasn't a majority, but it was the most radical fringes of things, not necessarily always at the camp, but in things that I was reading as well. So it didn't fit well. And it wasn't my overall way of thinking for very long. And I was very much brought back into accepting the goodness in all people by the kindness of men. Actually, when my father was dying, there were some men who were very kind to me as I tried to get back to him when I was traveling, and people helped me out. So,
you know, that was what was beautiful. It's like you came, you know, it's so beautiful. So tell us, so let's not go too much into the story because we don't want to give it away. But so tell us after Greenham, because that's the book finishes, you know, at the end of that. But tell us about your life since then.
After Greenham, I went to live. Eventually, I ended up in Brighton, where I joined the Stop the Claws movement. So I carried on being an activist, and I ran a queer...
Is that Clause 28?
Yes, yeah. Clause 28, which was an anti-gay and lesbian piece of law. And Brighton, a very queer city, and lots of us got together when we created this group. I mean, it was a national group. We had a very big one in Brighton. And I started with some friends a magazine called A Queer Tribe. And that's we ran that for a couple of years. Yeah, really? It was a lot of fun. Yeah. And the word queer was not very popular then either. So I was very happy. I actually love that word. Mm. And then after living there, I spent a year on the border with Wales, where I did my teaching degree in Aberystwyth. And then I ended up moving to New York. My sister was here, my younger sister, and I came to visit her, fell in love, and with the city, I mean, and ended up staying here. And my first job was with a gay and lesbian bookstore called A Different Light. I taught English at a local university. And then I found my calling again with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, we call it over here, the International Medical Aid Organization, where I worked in communications, doing events and writing and things like that.
Fantastic. And now what's your job now? It's something to do with drugs and helping poor people in need.
Yes, that's right. I'm working now as a consultant writing in events for the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, which was created by Médecins Sans Frontières to try and address the fact that a lot of the diseases that doctors and nurses were encountering in the course of their work, there were no treatments for them, or not good treatments for them. They even could be toxic. There was one for sleeping sickness that the treatment itself killed one in 20 patients. So DNDI, the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, has now come out with a pill that cures the disease and doesn't kill you. I mean, it just works. So so that's what I'm working on now.
Sounds brilliant. So what was the inspiration for writing this book now in your life?
Well, I went to a writing workshop at the Woodstock Writers Festival near me.
Great.
And the memoir teacher, Bev D'Onofrio, who wrote Riding in Cars with Boys, was just so brilliant. And she said, well, I had been writing for others all my professional life, but never doing my own writing. I'd done little bits here and there, but I'd not really done anything. And so I went to her workshop because I liked the sound of her. And she said, go where the heat is. And I just said, oh, I mean, I was thrown back to the 18-month period that I describe in the book when I lived at Greenham Common. And I started writing and I couldn't stop. And I joined her workshop in Woodstock, went every week. I learned so much from her about the craft of writing. And as soon as I kind of got it, how to zoom in and zoom out and balance things, off I went. I just enjoyed it so much. And I fitted the writing around my paying job so that I could get it finished.
It's fantastic. Well, congratulations. And the book is out today. And I recommend anyone out there who's just inspired by just a fantastic story to go out and buy there. Have you got any message that you'd like to give to people before you go?
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, when you mentioned your daughter, it made me think about how much I would love young women to read this, particularly in terms of not doing what I did in relationship and having a sense of self-worth and having some boundaries and not being with someone because they feel they should be with someone. You know, I would love young women to have a sense of empowerment about how to be in the world. And also, Greenham Common was such a massive movement that it's disappeared somewhat from history, from how we talk about history, because it's women's history. I think we have to keep it alive ourselves. And that's why I'm so grateful for your podcast. So you're bringing in women, you have this women-only space on the airwaves that is keeping our stories alive. So I'm very grateful for that. And I hope people go and learn more about Greenham Common after.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous, Stephanie Davis. And Other Girls Like Me by Stephanie Davis is published by Bedazzled Inc. and it's out now. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.